Esther chapter 5. Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. So the scepter, of course, is just a big stick. Looks like a walking cane made out of gold, and, you know, kings would carry these things as a symbol of their authority. And so she came up, and she followed the protocol, and she had the guts to go up there and stand there, because when she entered into that court, if he didn't put the scepter out, it's the death penalty, because the king had not called on her. Verse 3, then the king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you." Now notice the contrast here. The first wife, Vashti, was asked to come into the king and refused to come. She was not asked, and she came. So she's gutsy, and she's smart, and she's obedient. She's got all those things that the king finds attractive other than her outward appearance. And so he's obviously, this is a idiom when it says even to half the kingdom. You've seen that idiom before. King Herod, for example, with the dancing girls, and John the Baptist. So it's an idiom that he would give you basically whatever you want. Verse 4, Esther said, "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you, even what is your request?" And what is your request? "Even to half the kingdom, it shall be done." So she wants to do this in a private way. She doesn't want to do it out in the court with everybody listening and put the king on the spot, because she knows that once the king makes a royal decree, the king can't go back on the royal decree. And he would be put in a very embarrassing situation. The first queen embarrassed the king when she refused to come. Had egg all over his face. So she wants to do these things in a private setting, and so she's very smart about that. She knows who's responsible for this stuff also, is this Haman fellow. She knows this is the individual that has stirred up all this trouble. He's the one that did the decree, and so she's going to have to confront him as well as make the request to the king. So in her mind, she figures, well, I'm going to do this in a private setting, but obviously I've got to have my opponent here as well, because if I do it in front of the king, then he will be able to tell the king at a later time that this isn't right or this isn't right. So she's going to put Haman on the spot. She's not going to be on the spot. She's going to put Haman on the spot, and she's figuring out the best way to do that is to bring that individual that's opposing your position and put them in the same room, and that's what she did. And so the king says, "What is it did you want?" Verse 7, so Esther replied, "My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." Verse 9, then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. Haman controlled himself, however, went to his house, and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeresh. Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him and how he had promoted him above the princes and the servants of the king. Haman also said, "Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she has prepared, and tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king. Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully with the king to the banquet." And the advice pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Again, the hanging here, you're going to be impaled with a stake in a very high place. So this individual, Haman, obviously is bragging to his family and his friends all the position and the power that he has, and he knows that the king dearly loves Esther, and he is extremely fat-headed that he's been invited to this banquet, and only the king and Haman are invited to this personal banquet that Esther is throwing, and so he's greatly excited by that because he thinks that Esther is doing it because she's recognizing his great power in the kingdom. But that is not why she's doing it. She's doing it because, again, when she breaks the news to the king about what her request is, she's also at the same time got to confront Haman because he's the one that's caused all this trouble. So she's putting everything on the table. She's going to do it all at one time and not do like these gossip sessions and he said, she said, and then what did you say? They're all going to be right there to confront each other, and the king is going to make a decision at that time. Chapter 6. During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of the records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. So again, this is the night before the banquet, and the banquet, again, it's, you might call it a dinner party, because who's at the dinner party? It's the queen, the king, and Haman. And so the king can't sleep, and he asks that these chronicles be brought and read before him. Verse 2, it was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Assyrius. Lay hands is an idiom for they sought to kill him. Verse 3, the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Now God controls history. Usually, if you do a service like that to the king, you're going to be rewarded, sack of gold or something of that nature. But Mordecai was never rewarded. It was just recorded in the book who had done it, who had turned these people in, and how these things happened, and these people want to kill the king. But nothing had ever been done for Mordecai, which is quite strange. But God controls history. Even in the minutest thing, he controls history. As we know, our Lord said he can count every hair on your head. And there's not a sparrow that falls to the ground that he doesn't know about it. So when you see things that, oh, that's injustice, that's terrible, not really. Because nothing happens that God does not allow to occur. Now, we know that Satan's the ruler of the world. He allows sin in the world. He allows suffering in the world. He allows these things to occur in the plan of God. But for the believer, of course, he holds you in his hand, and nothing happens to you that is not known to God a long, long, long time ago. So is there really a tragedy in your life? Not really. I mean, it might seem like suffering at the time, and obviously it is suffering, but is it tragic? No, we must conclude it's not tragic. It's in the plan of God, and God has put that before us in a way to advance us to spiritual maturity, because that's the goal. The goal is to reach spiritual maturity. All the other things are just details. Details, details, details. And the glory and the wonderful thing about God is he can take our screw-ups and turn those into great blessing. So even the screw-ups that we do, God knew you'd screw up. And when I say you, yes, you and me, we all screw up. But he has turned those cursings into blessings. All we have to do is rebound and keep studying Bible doctrine, and you cannot lose. So at this time, Mordecai was never rewarded, and that's in the plan of God. It's not a coincidence that he was never rewarded. It's not a coincidence that the king has insomnia, because God, of course, knew that the king would have insomnia. He knew all these things would occur. And of course, this is what apparently the king would do, is he'd pull off the history books and let me read about my empire, what's going on. And that's a smart king. You want to find out, you've got a lot of provinces, and you usually have to read the reports and read the dispatches and tell me what's going on in the chronicles, because I want to make sure that I'm doing things that are correct and that things are running smoothly. So this particular time, the page or the person that's reading it turned to that particular chapter of the chronicles and starting reading about these things that occurred several years before. Verse 4, so the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows, which he had prepared for him. So at this very time that Haman is coming in to ask the king for permission to execute this person, the king is thinking about how am I going to reward Mordecai? And there are no coincidences. Now, when you look back on your life, you might say, well, I never deserved to do that, and that should never happen. Of course it shouldn't happen. God made it happen. So if God is for you, who's against you? Nobody can be against you. So God sews all these things together in a magnificent way, in a mosaic that's beyond our comprehension. And also, God has a great sense of humor. So at the same time the king is going to reward him, this fellow's coming in to get a death warrant for Mordecai. Coming in the palace at the same time. 5, the king's servant said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? Now remember, Haman just can't go into the king. Haman has to wait to be called. And so when the king said, who's in the court? Haman's in the court. Have him come into the court. Haman would also have to go through a protocol. He just can't bang into the king's doors. And so he's asking him a question. What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman said to himself, who would the king desire to honor more than me? Yes, he's a very arrogant person. He's thinking that I'm going to get another set of riches because the king recognizes that the queen has invited me to the dinner party, and therefore I must be really, really, really special now, and therefore I'm going to even get more rewards from the king. So he is really getting his chest all puffed up. 7, then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. So Haman didn't ask for a lot of money. He just asked, I want to be recognized by society. I want to be on the king's white horse with a crown, a purple robe, and paraded through the streets, that I am somebody to be paid attention to. He lusted in his soul for approbation. Approbation lust is part of a lust pattern. We know this because obviously he was very upset when Mordecai wouldn't stand up when he walked by. He just kept sitting. And that really offended him. He wants the recognition of other people as much as he wants the money. And so that's what he wants. I want to be recognized. Verse 10, then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Now we don't have the missing stuff in here, but you can imagine when this thing hit, he must have just really had a fit inside when this thing occurred. But he has no choice because he has pronounced exactly what is supposed to be done to a man that the king desires to honor. And so he is also caught in his own trap that God, of course, has sprung. 12, then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home mourning with his head covered. Haman recounted to Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh, his wife, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. And so they're giving a very dire prediction to Haman, that this is bad news for you, very bad news for you. 14, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. So now we're going to the banquet. He has done this thing. He's been humiliated. Mordecai has been elevated. Instead of killing him, he's had to lead him around on this white horse. And it's quite a turn of events because God controls history. God controls everything. So you might say to yourself, well, my life's kind of boring right now. Not much is happening. Lots happening. Lots is happening. Every time you choose to rebound, a lot is happening. Ephesians chapter 6 is an unseen conflict. And most churches today, they like to really emphasize unity in the church. The church is going to do this, the church is going to do that, and they talk about building boats or houses or doing this, and all those things are wonderful things. But that's not the job of a local church. The local church is really made up of individuals. It's the individuals that go out from the local church, and it's you against the world. There's nobody there with you. When you die, there's nobody goes to the valley of the shadow of death with you. There's no other human that goes with you. And so when Paul says, put on the full armor, he doesn't say, the church put on the full armor. It's individuals. Study to show yourself approved unto God. Individuals. The battle is between you and the cosmos. And there's nobody in a church that's going to help you. But see, most organizations, they want to have the organization do it. And therefore, I can just be a plug or a cog or a wheel or a spoke in the organization. Our church here is very different because we don't have an organization to do anything. We just put out Bible doctrine. And you go out and put on the shield and the helmet and the sword, and you do your own battle. And you report back to headquarters, hey, I did this and that, that's fine. But it's between you and the Lord. Whether you succeed or whether you fail, none of my business. And it's nobody else's business, unless you want to make it their business. Some people like to make it the business of other people, and that's fine. But basically, it's you versus the cosmic system. And that's one of the things I find very unique in these churches. They're all about the unity of doing things in the church. Whatever it is, we're going to have a big church picnic, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and the church is doing this, and the church is doing that. Where do you see that in the Bible? In the Bible, you see individuals are always emphasized. Paul, in his letter to Timothy, he doesn't say, all y'all go out here and put on t-shirts for the 50th reunion of your family, and we're all going to get out here. No, it's individual. It's individual combat. We're on the team, that's true. But ultimately, it's individual combat, and you engage in that combat every time you rebound. Every time you take in Bible doctrine, every time you pass a test or fail a test, you're in individual combat. When you fail the test, they get a swipe at you, but you pull up your shield and block it and take another swipe back. You're not dead yet. If you're dead, then yeah, it's over. So you might get wounded and knocked down, but you keep getting up. Keep getting up and fight, 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 fight. It's an individual conflict. And when you get rewarded, the church is not rewarded at the judgment seat of Christ. The individual is rewarded at the judgment seat of Christ. Each person gets their own individual rewards for what you did. You can't run on somebody else's Bible doctrine. Somebody else in that church might have a lot of Bible doctrine. That doesn't help you. You've got to develop your own, and God will use you in this angelic conflict. Now, these people are obviously visible heroes. You are an invisible hero. And your name might not be in the book of Esther, but your name's in God's history books, his chronicles that are written in heaven. And so now he's going to the banquet, chapter 7. Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the king said to Esther on the second day also that they drank their wine at the banquet. Banquets would usually last 2 or 3 days, these dinner parties. They would last a long time. So apparently we know that this was on a second day dinner party. Also, they drank their wine at the banquet. What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. Then Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request. So her petition is, I don't want to be killed. And this is a strange thing. The king said, what? What do you mean you don't want to be killed? You're my queen. There's nobody going to kill you. And my people as my request. So he said, what do you mean my people? I'm sure these thoughts are going through his brain. Verse 4. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed and be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent. For the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. In other words, I don't want to bother you with this. If we were just going to be enslaved, I wouldn't even bother you. But we're set to be killed on a certain day in the future. Verse 5. Then King Assyrius asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? 6. Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. So see, she's got him right there. And so when she makes her request, she also points the finger at the person that's responsible for this great evil that's about ready to befall things. And the king, of course, is not in a public setting. Now, the king's got a dilemma, as we're going to see, because he's already issued the decree. And a royal decree in the Persian Empire, you can't undo it. It's got to be carried forward. And so the king realizes that as well. So it's not a matter that he can just say, okay, I abrogate that royal decree. Now, we can do that in our society. Our Supreme Court abrogates things all the time. But in the Persian culture, when the king gave the word, he's like God. In their mind, God doesn't change his mind. So this decree from the king cannot be abrogated. It will happen on that particular day that anybody that wants to hunt Jews and kill them, they can get their property. And that is going to happen. Verse 7, so the king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. So he could see the king's demeanor was very, very upset. Why is the king upset? Why did he arise? Because of what I just told you. The decree cannot be undone. It's a decree. And the king, of course, is part of the Persian Empire, and he can't go back on his word. Same dilemma he had with the first queen. Can't go back on the word that she has disobeyed me, but he put the scepter out to her because that was part of the protocol. It spared her life. Verse 8. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? So this is not a good thing. He came back in and he's thinking that, well, this guy's trying to beat up on my queen, and he just threw himself down there to beg. But on first sight, when he walks in, he sees this sight, and that doesn't make him happy either. And this is not a coincidence. God controls history, and God had him come back in that room at just the time when this knucklehead is throwing his body at the queen. And the impression is he's trying to assault the queen. As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So again, the eunuchs are still in the room. The servants are still there. And they were going to let Mordecai assault the queen. So as soon as the king said these words, they jumped the guy and covered his face. They put a sack over, probably a big sack over his face, tied him up and let him out. And again, people gossip. And this individual, they all knew that Haman was going to kill Mordecai. He built these big gallows and let everybody know that he was going to do it, and bragging about it. So the king said, hang him on it. It should be impale him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. So again, this person was a victim of his own evil plots, and God controlled history, and these things turned out exactly as they should have turned out. And Queen Esther, of course, passed the test, and these things fell into place perfectly as God had ordained them to turn out. And chapter 8. Now we've got the final problem here of what to do about the decree. On that day, King Assuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her, her adopted father, in other words. The king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So he inherited all the riches and the wealth that this guy had, and he has a signet ring, which means he's now the prime minister, which is a good choice. This is a born-again believer, a mature believer, and he understands the laws of divine institutions. He's a wonderful choice to be the prime minister, and this is not the first time a Jew has risen to the top echelons in the Bible. Remember Joseph in the Pharaoh of Egypt at the time. He was a prime minister. This occurred quite often. Remember Daniel. He was elevated to very high authorities under the Chaldeans and under the Persians. Verse 3. Then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, so Esther arose and stood before the king. Then the king said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Haman-i-Dath-ah, the Agite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So King Assuerus said to Queen Esther, and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther, and him they have hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hands against the Jews." Verse 8. "Now you write to the Jews as you see fit." Remember, he's now the prime minister. He got the ring. "In the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for the decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring may not be revoked." So the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month of Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia. From India to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is northern Africa. India is way out there. Provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. He wrote in the name of King Assyrius and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. We do the same thing in Kentucky here. You get the fastest horse, and that's the horse that is used to carry on the bloodline for other horses. So they obviously had some very wonderful horses. 11. "In them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil." So remember, the decree that Haman had written didn't say the Persian military was going to do it. It just said that anybody who wants to go out, it's open season on Jews, so they could seize their property. The Persian military will not participate in this event that's coming up, but other people have the opportunity if they want to. So now this second decree says that these people can organize, they can have weapons, they can assemble themselves, set up a training system, a militia, and then it says, they can destroy and annihilate the entire army of any people, and they get the plunder. So these Jews will be able to confiscate all the wealth of anybody that's attacking them. They will forfeit not only their lives, but all their wealth. And that'll keep a lot of people from wanting to attack Jews. Because if you lose, then all your stuff is gone. On 12, "On one day in all the provinces of King Assyrius, the 13th day of the month, of the 12th month, that is the month of Adar." That's when this decree is going to be executed by Haman. That was about a year from the time that he issued it. And that date is rapidly approaching. So that they have one day where they can go out and attack these Jews. 13, "A copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the people so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers hastened and impaled by the king's command went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the capital in Susa. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews were there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And each and every province and in each and every city, whether the king's commandment and his decrees, wherever the king's commandment and decrees arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them." How do you become a Jew? Well, we call it proselytes. A Gentile can convert to the Jewish faith. And so therefore they would say, "I will convert to the Jewish faith, and therefore on this particular day when the trouble starts, I'll be able to plunder anybody that attacks me and I'll take all their property." So they see that the Jews are now have a favored status in the Persian Empire. They know that Mordecai is a Jew and he's a prime minister. And so they decide that they are also going to become Jews, partly for personal interest of wealth or, for whatever purpose. Some of them may have become Jews because they are actually on positive volition and wanted to become believers in the coming Messiah, which would be their salvation. But others, of course, just saw an opportunity to be with the people that are on the in right now instead of on the out. Because with the decree from Haman, obviously the Jews are going to be on the out. And now the word of what has happened to Haman is spread everywhere. And that Mordecai is now the prime minister, that's spread everywhere. The fact that Queen Esther is a Jew, that's spread everywhere. And the king and what he had done, that story is out. So the Jews had gone from a position of being, you know, susceptible of being wiped out to now being in a very top position in Persian society, and therefore everybody wants to be a Jew. Whether they truly want to be born again or not is a different question, but many people want to be Jews. So we're not going to get into chapter 9. We'll finish that up for our next Bible class, but in reviewing things, we've got several valuable lessons here, and basically what I would just say is, you know, as Mordecai said to Esther, who knows? You know, you just don't know what's going to happen in your life. But you do your duty. You saw the wood in front of you. When the opportunity comes before you, we all have to make choices. And it's easy to choose between good and bad. Sometimes you got to choose between the lesser of two evils. Sometimes you got to choose between good and good. Because the right thing has to be done in the right way. And you have to make those determinations on what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and when and where. And I can't tell you what choices to make in things. I can barely tell myself what choices to make sometimes. But when in doubt, take your time, think about it, and then the moment of absolute certainty will never arise. So you simply apply the Bible doctrine you have to the test and make your best choice. And knowing that even if your best choice was the wrong choice, well, God knew you'd make the wrong choice. And further down the road, he has turned that cursing into blessing. But as long as you are deliberate and think about it, notice all these things are very deliberate. What Mordecai did, what Esther did, they didn't just shoot off at the mouth. They did things very deliberately. They tried to follow the law as it then existed, the rule of law in the Persian Empire. They did things under the protocol system that they had in place, and they followed the procedures, but they did it in a way that was to their own advantage. And so what might have motivated her to have that dinner party was she didn't want to embarrass the king, but she knew she'd have to confront Haman, and therefore she was very smart to do this dinner party, obviously, because then she can make the request and also point out the fact of the person that's responsible for her asking for her life. And the way she put the request was very smart too. She didn't say, well, the Jews are going to be destroyed. She put it right up front because she knew that the king was very impressed with her, and therefore she knew that she was going to identify herself with the Jews. She wasn't going to try to hide behind the fact that, well, I used to be a Jew, now I'm not a Jew. She came right up front. Yep, I'm a Jew, and therefore I'm going to be killed. And so the king had given great trust and authority to Haman, because you can't run everything yourself. And he saw that Haman had betrayed that trust and authority for his own personal gain. And God has a way, of course, of bringing these things back on us. And this individual, as an unbeliever, had self-induced misery, and God turned his cursing into his cursing. Now, Haman had an equal opportunity to be a believer. He had contact with Mordecai. He could have went the other way. He could have said, why don't you Jews stand up and do these things? And he could have explained to him the gospel, what it was. Well, I see you Jews are a very valuable component to the Persian Empire. I'm going to let you keep your customs, and you got the divine institutions down. Have a great day. But that wasn't him. He's an arrogant person, and his arrogance was manifested in all the things that he did. He's always thinking about me, me, me. What can I do? What can I do? How can I advance myself? Obviously, though, he's a very smart administrator. The king wouldn't have chosen him to be the prime minister early on. So he had a lot of good qualities, but the thing that killed him was locked-in arrogance. And that got the better of him, and it destroyed him. And arrogance goes before a fall. And his fall, of course, was to be impaled on the very gallows that he had set up for Mordecai, because God controls history. He controls your life. He controls my life. There are no surprises. There are absolutely no surprises. And if you're surprised, that's nice, but God's never surprised. With our head bowed and our eyes closed, Father, we thank you for the privilege of studying your holy word this morning. We pray that God, the Holy Spirit, will challenge us, make us aware of these things and how we can apply these lessons to our own lives as we march through time into eternity, into your arms. In Jesus Christ's name, amen.